Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We might make a start. Welcome to today's Senate Occasional Lecture. My name's Tim Bryant. I'm the Director of Research in the Department of the Senate. In welcoming you, I'd like to acknowledge and show my respect to the traditional custodians of this land and their elders, past and present. I would also like to acknowledge other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may be present. Today, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Zare Gazarian from Monash University. Dr. Gazarian is a political scientist in the School of Social Sciences at Monash University and author of many publications, including Australian Politics for Dummies. I'm sure there's a joke there somewhere, but I'll leave it alone at this stage. Dr. Gazarian's topic today, though, is the evolution of small parties elected to the Australian Senate, which will pick up some of the ideas in his recent book, and by all means, Dr. Gazarian, you can hold it up, we'll have a little plug, The Making of a Party System, Minor Parties in the Australian Senate. His lecture also marks the 40th anniversary of the election of the Australian Democrats to the Senate in 1977. It'll be fascinating to hear his observations about how he got from there to here. I might also take this opportunity to mention just briefly that the ACT chapter of the Australasian Study of Parliament Group, a group established to encourage and stimulate research, writing, teaching and discussion about parliamentary institutions, and of which I'm the chair at the moment, hence this little advertorial, are running a post-lecture discussion group immediately after Senate lectures this year in 2017 for those for whom too much parliamentary discussion is never enough. The group will be meeting in the Queen's Terrace Cafe, just along from this theatre, immediately after Dr. Gazarian's lecture to discuss the issues he raises. It's very informal, but feel free to grab a coffee and just join in. But that's enough from me. Could you please welcome Dr. Gazarian?
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for that very generous introduction by Tim. My name is Zare Gazarian, and firstly I'd like to thank, of course, the Clerk of the Senate for extending the invitation for me to be here today. It's a wonderful honour for me to be invited to present my research to such an engaged group, and of course to do it in this incredible building which I just had a private tour of. Thank you to Tim. I'd also like to thank Filia Antonino, who has looked after all the sorts of logistical arrangements for me to be here today, making all the necessary organisational appointments and jumping through all those hoops. So thank you to her as well. And of course, thank you to Tim. And thank you to be here. It's a beautiful day outside. So we were sort of thinking about how many people would actually trade listening to someone up here or enjoying the sun outside. So thank you all for coming. Today I'd like to I have a number of points that I'd like to discuss and see what you would make of them. I don't want this to be an incredibly formal lecture, but of course, sticking to convention, the outline is there. My focus today is to look at a sense of evolution in the type of minor party that the Australian Senate has seen elected to it since the end of the Second World War in particular up until the last election of 2016. And to draw that sort of sense of evolution out, I would like to focus on the sorts of issues that these parties have presented elections, have contested elections on, and of course to consider the role that they themselves have sought to play in the Australian political system. Of course, as Tim mentioned in the introduction, this is the 40th anniversary of perhaps one of the most significant minor parties elected ever to Parliament, and that is the Australian Democrats. And I'll be spending a bit of time looking at their very important contribution to Australian politics and, of course, the shape of minor parties that follow after that as well. And ultimately, to look at, if we have some time, the electoral facts that we see from the data, where minor parties are increasing their support, the state of the major parties, and debates for the future. So, let us get started. Very, very quickly, to contextualise this discussion, and it's often a question I'm asked, why are you looking at minor parties, number one, and number two, why are you looking at minor parties in the Senate? Of course, the Australian Senate is an incredibly powerful, a very important, very powerful chamber. And I think Stanley Buck, in his 2003 book, made this incredible comparison between the very powerful upper house that we have in Australia and the platypus. Essentially, two very unique, very Australian entities, each with its own charm, but ultimately nothing that you'll find somewhere else. Of course, the British model, which we inherit much of our system from, doesn't have anything like such a powerful Senate, nor does, of course, the American system, which we get federalism and the idea of the Australian Senate from. But up until the 1940s and into 1948, the system of voting for the Senate ultimately resulted in lopsided outcomes, where there would be the major parties winning almost all the seats, and there would be a handful of independents, but ultimately you'd have a system where it was either opposition-dominated or government-dominated. And this, of course, leads to problems of governance. The idea of the Senate, of course, was to be the state's house, to represent, to advance the agendas, the interests, and the policy demands of individual states. But when you have such a system prior to the 1950s, where you have all the seats essentially going to the major parties, you have a debate where how likely is it that the chamber will actually do what it promised to do? And of course, these sorts of debates, Jack Lang, a very famous Labor Party politician, has made a very interesting observation there. This was made in a parliamentary debate at the time, where he argues, along with many others in the chamber, that the Australian Senate had become an outlived, dated institution that was up for, really, either rejuvenation or follow the lead of the Queenslanders and completely abolish it. Of course, that didn't happen, but what we did have instead was the chiefly Labor government seeking to change the way in which elections were held for the Senate. And we have the introduction of proportional representation from 1949 onwards. Now, the idea of proportional representation, there are debates about as to why this was seen to be a good idea by the chiefly government. Some would say, perhaps cynically, that this was an attempt by the chiefly government to safeguard itself against potential swings that it could foresee in the upcoming elections. But ultimately, the reforms are rarely as the reformers would like them to be, and I think that's what's happened in this case. I would just like to very quickly go through, and I'm not sure how well people's eyesight is up the back with this little tiny font, just to give you a very broad overview of the parties that we'll be touching on and considering, as I believe these are the ones that are very significant in trying to chart the evolution of minor parties in the Australian Senate. The change to the voting system did not have an immediate impact in the electoral outcomes. From 49 up to 53, 55, there was no change, except, of course, when we start to see the DLP, the Democratic Labor Party, which first wins a seat in the 1950s. Of course, that is a party, and we'll talk about later on. But from there, you can see that there's a huge gap, about 20 years between the next minor party that gets elected, and that's the Liberal movement in the mid-1970s. Then come the Australian Democrats in 77. And then after that, we have a cavalcade of minor parties being elected to the Senate in a 30-odd year period. While there were, for example, three minor parties elected in 30 years before 1983-84, from that period on, we see many more elected. I will be looking at reasons why we can use to try and explain this shift as well. But first and foremost, let's look at these early parties. I'm looking at these early parties in trying to construct an analytical framework, which I hope I'll be able to get your feedback on at the end of this discussion. The Democratic Labor Party, of course, and I was very pleased to see some experts on the DLP who've attended this lecture, so I'll be very, very careful. And if I say something that's a bit out of kilter, I'm an open target, as long as you don't throw anything. The DLP, of course, came from a split in the Labor Party over the issue of communism. And there were the anti-communist forces, which were very concerned about the ideology seeping into all sorts of decisions that the Labor Party was making. And there were forms and ways in which the Labor Party sought to establish an anti-communist force within its own organisation. This, of course, came to a head. I'm cutting a very long story short. We could perhaps have a series of lectures only on the Labor Party. But in terms of cutting this short, we have a split emerge in the Australian Labor Party. Those very much concerned about communism or the idea that communism existed in the Labor Party split off from the major party and constructed the DLP. The DLP in its position in the Australian parliamentary system was fairly straightforward. It was anti-communist, it was to a large extent socially conservative, but I would argue, first and foremost, it was a party that was set up to stop Labor from getting back into government. And ultimately, it was able to do that for a number of decades. It was able to stop Labor from winning elections between 55 up until the turning point in 1972 when the Whitlam-led Labor Party was able to re-enter the parliamentary benches, this time in government, not in opposition. Once Labor regained government, its purpose for being was diminished. And I would argue that from that point onwards, the DLP itself starts to disintegrate. It starts to evaporate, and up until earlier this decade, it was non-existent in politics, something I'll return to later on. In a similar way, I think the Liberal Party showed elements of being a fragmentary party, not so from the Labor Party this time, but now from the Liberals. The Liberal movement was headed by Steele Hall, who was a South Australian premier, and he was a very progressive, socially progressive leader who wanted to reform the state's electoral system. He was also, in terms of social policy, very progressive, and this caused conflict between him and his colleagues, especially at the federal level. Steele Hall sought to not be like the DLP. He did not want to have a party that would be out to stop a major party from winning government. But he actually does something that was very new and novel at the time. He constructs the Liberal movement with the view to be an intermediary, a party that will, as the Democrats later say, to keep the bastards honest. A party that will be in the Senate to use the Senate's powers to exert influence not so much on what policies governments do, but more so on the sorts of behaviours and overall ideas that come through from the lower house. His goal was to ensure that the Senate would keep a check on the lower house. And that was, of course, the idea that gave rise to the Australian Democrats. I think they are a very significant party, and they have revitalised the Senate, and arguably their contribution to Australian politics is still being felt well after their demise, around about 10 years ago. The Australian Democrats, of course, there's a picture there with Don Chipp addressing a town hall meeting, and I believe that was a town hall meeting in Springvale Town Hall in Melbourne, where you can see it was packed to the rafters, literally packed to the rafters. Such was the ability for Don Chipp to generate interest in his political beliefs. Of course, Chipp himself was a former Liberal minister and was a potential leadership challenger to Malcolm Fraser. Chipp, having felt disappointed with the leadership of the Liberal Party and the bipartisan and the anti-bipartisan sentiments in Canberra, decided that he wanted to address this shortcoming. And of course, here I believe the 1975 constitutional crisis, where Gough Whitlam was ultimately dismissed by the Governor-General after the Senate did not pass the budget. I think that is an incredibly important turning point for minor parties in the Australian system, because it not only showed the importance of the Senate, the power of the Senate, but it also demonstrated that there was this very potentially toxic partisan culture in federal parliament that could at any time rerun again. It could occur again. And constitutionally, of course, we have a situation where a 75 constitutional crisis may occur again. The idea of the Democrats was to keep the bastards honest, a famous tagline they first used at the 1980 federal election. And they also brought about different ideas in terms of internal organisation, which I also argue has an impact on modern political parties. Rather than keep a very hierarchical structure where there was a leader, deputies, office bearers, the Democrats flipped that on their head, and they included every single member in the decision-making process of the party. They opened up debates about policies, the policies that they would be pursuing in Parliament, to the ordinary member. Now, sometimes, of course, the ordinary member treated that with some disdain. I think the average response to a policy question was about 5 to 10% of the overall party membership, but ultimately demonstrated that there could be new ways, different ways of structuring a party, positioning the party in the party system, and ultimately exerting influence on the decisions of government. We will come back to the Democrats later. Then we have the Hawke government appearing at the 1983 election, winning after 7 years, 8 years of being in opposition. This is the first government after the Whitlam era from Labor. The Hawke government had an ambitious agenda to reform the electoral system, especially for the Senate. And you can see there in the graphic there, there's the much liked or much loathed modern Senate ballot paper, some where you have so many candidates the Australian Electoral Commission now has to give out little magnifying glasses too for people to see. This was an important part that I believe has an impact on the shape and the nature of parties elected to the Senate from this point onwards. Not only was there an increase in the number of senators from 10 to 12, there was also the introduction of the group voting ticket, the group ticket vote. And that's, of course, the line, the introduction of the line. And ultimately what this reform meant is that by voters simply putting one above the black line, the party of their choice would distribute the preferences as they saw fit, as they had organised. And this, combined with the fact that there was election funding now introduced for all parties to take advantage of, contributed to a sense that there was a reduction in the electoral thresholds facing new minor parties and candidates for the Senate. This reform in particular, these suite of reforms, made getting to the Senate just a bit easier for new parties. And of course, one of the big reasons for that was by increasing the number of senators from 10 to 12, you have a fall in the quota that's needed by a candidate to win a seat. So it fell from around about 16.5 to 17% down to around 14.5%. Clearly a reduction in the size of challenge confronting new minor parties. And we can see that in 1984, the first election where these reforms were introduced, we have a very big development. We have the rise of what I believe and consider to be the new type of minor party. Started off from the political left. And this is the Nuclear Disarmament Party. This was a party that was set up by Michael Denbrough, a medical scientist who was based in Canberra. I had the pleasure of interviewing him some years ago. Unfortunately, he's since passed away. But the insight that he provided was fascinating in terms of structuring and organising this new party. And you could see from his discussions about this party and, of course, the literature that exists, this was qualitatively different to a party that had gone before. The NDP was all about anti-nuclear, pro-peace and cosmopolitan values in politics. And rather than invest in organisation, the party had, I'd say, almost virtually no organisation to speak of. Where the Democrats, we thought, were very fluid in their organisation, the NDP was something else. They operated much like a social movement where there was virtually no hierarchy. More than that, the party itself had three clear policy objectives, and all of these were party objectives that had been jettisoned by the incoming Hawke government, and they all, surprise, surprise, as the name would suggest, centred around nuclear disarmament. In particular, the NDP was very much concerned about Australia's foreign policy that was linked with the United States so closely, and the Three Mines policy that the Labor government implemented to have three operational uranium mines going on. The party was able to win one Senate spot, but of course it's not the gentleman who's pictured in the greyed-out image there. It's not Peter Garrett. He ran, of course, in New South Wales, and he was seen to be a real threat by the Labor Party, in particular Graham Richardson, who I believe was the secretary of the ALP in New South Wales at the time. It's interesting that Mr. Richardson has also made a contribution in today's The Australian, which is a very interesting read. The idea was that Garrett was a threat, and so to stop the NDP threatening Labor seats, potential seats in the Senate, the Labor Party would use the new group voting ticket method to ensure that the NDP got their last preferences. Ultimately, they were blocked by the use of the voting preferences. This wasn't such a concern for Labor in WA, in Western Australia, where Joe Valentine, running as an NDP candidate, was able to claim a seat. She was able to win it and was able not only to be there for that period, but also was able to spawn and create and be very much active in a couple of other new minor parties elected from that point on. The Valentine Peace Group, of course, a WA phenomenon, which ultimately was combined in with the WA Greens, which lasted in the Senate from 1990 till the mid-2000s. All of these parties, these three parties, I believe, and argue, have links to the peace and disarmament movement in Australia and, of course, the NDP at the time. The Australian Greens, which first win their seat in 1996, is slightly different. This is, of course, a party that's headed by Bob Brown, who became such a focal point for the party for decades. They're much more of an East Coast phenomenon when compared with the WA Greens. The Australian Greens were cosmopolitan in their outlook, were very much concerned with conservation, but they themselves also had tensions about whether they should be a political party and contest elections or whether they should remain outside of the parliamentary sphere and act as a social movement. Ultimately, the very pragmatic forces headed by Bob Brown won that argument, and they became a very successful third force in Australian politics, especially once the Democrats were no longer in the Senate. The Australian Greens also were very much game changers in that they were able to advance not only a domestic agenda, not only an international agenda, but they were also able to advance a different style of organisation as well, where they mixed and matched the most effective elements from the NDP and the previous peace approaches of having no real hierarchy. They've melded that with a more established party organisation. Of course, in 2003 and 2004, the WA Greens joined the Confederation and are now part of the Australian Greens. These are all from the left, and you can see from that 80s to mid-90s period, they were the ones able to win Senate representation. This changed in the late 90s and early 2000s. Rather than be concerned about cosmopolitan issues, rather than be concerned about peace and disarmament, the parties we see elected to the Senate from the late 90s and 2000s for the first time are from the political right. And of course, there's the iconic image of Pauline Hanson draped in the Australian flag, and she's had such great success electorally for the last two decades, although, of course, there was a period from the early 2000s up until the last election where she was non-existent in the policy and parliamentary debates. One Nation was very different to the other sorts of parties, not only in terms of policy, but also in terms of organisation. Rather than have a grassroots membership being represented by figureheads in Parliament, this party was very much about Pauline Hanson acting as a lightning rod for movements and groups to join her cause. As a charismatic figure, she presented herself as not a polished politician, a small business lady with experience dealing with local government, but of course not in terms of state government or at the federal level. One Nation was all about race, immigration, and a sense of mainstream values. The idea of mainstream values was also shared and advocated by Family First, which was first elected in 2004. Rather than be concerned about race and migration, however, Family First put at its core debates about social and moral values. The party was very much concerned about the rise of the Greens. In fact, I can remember one of the early Family First advertisements where there's a family sitting down to dinner. Of course, it's a nuclear family, and the father is eating the roast beef and vegetables, and the daughter, the actor, asks why you're not voting for the Greens, and the father starts to explain by using the peas as Greens and sort of demonstrating why he wouldn't be supporting them. It was a very interesting advertisement, which is still, I believe, available online. Very much concerned about the social fabric, very much concerned about the nuclear family, which comprised, in Family First's view, of a heterosexual couple and their children. And of course, Family First put great emphasis on this idea of ordinary voters, average Australians, mainstream values. In all of these sorts of lines, in all of these sorts of slogans, both Hanson's One Nation and Family First were fighting, if not explicitly, at least at the subliminal level, their concern about the rise of the Greens. And of course, we know by this stage, the Greens were very much a potent force in Australian politics. And they became much more potent in 2010 when they supported the Gillard Labor Party in forming minority government in the lower house. That 2010 election coincided with the rise of what I am calling the new DLP, because the DLP was back. It was back in the Senate, but it was very different to the DLP before. This time, the new DLP was concerned, similar to what Family First was advocating, concerned about social values, moral values. It was a socially conservative party. It was a party that was set up to ensure that it would ultimately advance the interests of the socially conservative elements in the electorate. And it did that very effectively. It did it effectively first at the Victorian level in the 2000s, and of course at the federal level in 2010. Anti-euthanasia, anti-drug harm minimisation approaches, anti-same-sex marriage, concerns about the rise and availability of illicit substances and pornography. These were issues that Family First and the new DLP were very much mobilised on. And the new DLP in particular had very strong links to the Right to Life movement, especially in Victoria, which it had some battles with later on in their parliamentary term. But ultimately, they were drawing on that sort of support to advance their agenda. So there is this sense that from the left being elected in the 80s and 90s and consolidating themselves thanks to the Australian Greens, we have the rise of minor parties from the right. But this raises the question of what we're seeing in more recent elections. And I think here, the class of 2013 gives us some insight into what's going on. There in the background, of course, is the smiling Clive Palmer crew, including Ricky Muir from the Motoring Enthusiast Party. All parties, the Palmer United Party, the Liberal Democrats and the Motoring Enthusiast Party, won seats for the first time in 2013. Arguably, it was a very interesting election result because we have a change of government, but the rise of an unprecedented number of new minor parties in the Senate. These three parties have common elements that bind them together. They are broadly from the political right. They are very much concerned about the size of government. And they are very much advocates of having small government. If we go through the sorts of articles and pamphlets and other paraphernalia that these parties have produced during the election campaign, it becomes clear that they are very much concerned with the role and power of the Australian Greens at the national parliamentary level, at the national government level. They talk in code about these sorts of elements. They talk about irresponsible minorities having too much power in Australian politics. They talk about freedoms being reduced for ordinary Australians by irresponsible minorities. And they all construct this idea that if they are not to be elected, if there is no voice for ordinary Australians, then the very fabric of Australian society will be deteriorating and will diminish. They presented themselves as upholders of common sense, as upholders of being anti-politician politicians, anti-establishment figures, which, if elected, they promised, would change the system. Now, of course, there are sorts of elements that are common in other parts of the world. I think we can draw elements and comparisons with this sort of approach between Pauline Hanson, Clive Palmer, the Liberal Democrats, and, of course, what we saw in the US with Donald Trump. All of these elements advocating that they are non-politicians promising to get elected and to fight for the average constituent. It didn't end there, of course, for watchers of minor parties in the Senate, because in 2016 we have the rise of three more brand new parties. Darren Hinch's Justice Party from Victoria, Jackie Lambie Network, of course, from Tasmania, and the Nick Xenophon team. And I was just thrilled to have seen Nick Xenophon in the building, which was very exciting. He's an extraordinary campaigner, and he's engaged in all sorts of campaign tools to boost his public profile. I think Darren Hinch's Justice Party and the Lambie Network are similar, not so much in their policy concerns with One Nation, but similar in terms of a very charismatic, well-known leader, galvanising support and ultimately mobilising support based on their high profile. Lambie perhaps is closer to the Hanson model, where she has also presented herself as being an anti-professional politician, someone who'll be in there trying to change the system. There are also overlaps, I believe, with Lambie and Hanson when it comes to immigration and their concern about religion, especially the rate of Muslims migrating to Australia. These sorts of things that have, however little support they do, they are able to contribute to the overall electoral support that these candidates get and are able to knock them across the line in tight Senate contests. I think the Nick Xenophon team continues the rich tradition of South Australian politics, in particular of being not so much an advocate, but using the role that he and his team have in Parliament and in the Senate to try and, be an intermediary in the chamber, to be the watchdog role that the Democrats once were, to ensure that neither major party uses their position in power to either implement rough policy or, of course, to frustrate the other side from getting on with government. I think he's demonstrated, and his team have demonstrated, that they are astute political negotiators, and they are very much able to withstand the sorts of polarisation in the electorate. They have done incredibly well in South Australia. It just remains to be seen how the Nick Xenophon team will continue on once, presumably at some point, Mr. Xenophon decides to move on. And I think there is that risk with all of these parties, from the right especially, that once their leader decides that it's time to move on, they do struggle in terms of trying to fill that void, in terms of ensuring that their organisation is robust enough to keep that party moving. With the sort of outline there, I'd like to just focus on some graphs, and I won't bore people too much with these graphs, but I think they paint a very interesting picture. And here we have the very first of these graphs, which demonstrates the state of the parties. This is the primary result, the primary vote of the major parties, comparing it to the minor parties. The line up there, the purple line, is the ALP and the Liberal National Party's primary vote combined, and the red line down the bottom is the minor party. So all parties other than the Labor and Liberal National parties. Clearly, there is a trend against the major parties. We can see that. I think we've sensed it. Any observer of Australian politics would be able to say that. There's also a clear line where we can see that the informal vote, which is that grey line, has remained constant and low, thankfully, suggesting that people are still engaged in the process and are happy to cast their vote as they see fit. The big fall comes in 2010 and 2013, which is this part there. Just that element there, you can see the tail end. Something's happening. Now, some would argue that it's the realisation by minor parties that they can contest and actually win seats, and therefore you have the proliferation of new minor parties. And I'll show a graphic which does demonstrate that there has been a rise in minor parties. Some have argued that the rise of minor parties in this time is part of gaming of the system, where the more minor parties you have, you can formulate little coalitions and swap preferences and ultimately get elected through those means. Or the third explanation is that, in fact, the minor party system and the electorate generally is responding to the policy debate of the time. Because when I show you the growth in where these parties are coming from, it's all from the political right. The political right is mobilising. It is getting much stronger. And it is not afraid of casting their hat in the electoral ring. They are mobilising new parties, and the more new parties there are, the more splintered that vote will be. The more splintered that vote will be, the lower the major party's primary vote. I'll just show you again another graph here, which looks at, this is a disaggregated vote to see who is losing the most when it comes to the major and minor parties. The blue line is the Liberal Party and National Party. The red line there is the Labor Party. And while they go through peaks and troughs, the last few elections, it's been Labor that's going down. And more significantly is that Labor's primary vote for the first time was eclipsed by non-major party votes for the first time ever. That's a significant and worrying problem for the Labor Party. Now, it could be that next time they increase, they get out of this hole, no problems. But I would think that a primary vote of less than 30% in the Senate is signalling that there's some sort of shift occurring. That's the Senate. What can we make of the House of Representatives, the House where government is made and unmade? Interestingly here, the major parties don't seem to be suffering the same drastic fall in their support. Sure, the line of best fit does indicate a general decline, But the primary vote is still around about 80% combined. That's much stronger than the 65% we saw in the Senate. And while others down there, the yellow line, are increasing in their support, they are still well short of reaching that magical 20% barrier. Again, just to demonstrate in a disaggregated state which party is winning or losing most, and again, it appears that Labor, it is Labor's primary vote that is suffering. It's Labor's primary vote that's dipped to that roughly 30% threshold. The coalition, the lowest they've dipped to was in 1998, around 40%, but they're still over that magical threshold. I think this is a graph that crystallises our debates. This is a graph that goes from 1984 to the last election, 2016, and it considers the major, the minor parties and where they come from, whether they are left, from the left, or from the right. Now, here I must thank my very good friend and colleague, Dr. Nick Economou from the School of Social Sciences, who's so generously shared this research with me. He's gone through the painstaking research of looking at where preferences are directed by parties and therefore coming to the conclusions that he has here. Ultimately, we see that there's been a general move in the right, which is the blue. The right of centre parties have arisen and they reached a peak of just under 20, I think that's 19 of them, in 2001. Then they were on a downward trajectory. But then in 2013 and 2016, we have a huge spike. Now, again, what can we use to make sense of this? The parties that are coming from this era are things such as the Shooters and Fishers parties, things such as the WikiLeaks party, which directed its preferences to the coalition rather than to the left of the political spectrum. We have other sorts of parties, of course, the Palmer United Party, the Sports Party. We have the Motoring Enthusiast Party, a whole cavalcade of new minor parties emerging, contesting elections, and, of course, chipping support away from the major parties. This does suggest, and I'm sure we can discuss this later, that there's something going on in the political debate that is mobilising the right. Whether it was that period of minority government between 2010 and 2013, where the perception was that the Greens had significant power in national politics, whether it was this sense that the coalition is not sufficiently to the right of some, and they are very concerned, so therefore they are constructing their own new political party. Or whether it is, as some critics have suggested, this sense that new minor parties are emerging to try and game the system in order to get elected. Having said all that, in 2016, the Turnbull government implemented a new system of voting, which knocks out pretty much all of that preference wheeling and dealing that we've seen between 84 and 2013. It's now much more difficult for a minor party to win a seat with a 0.05% of the primary vote. But we can't really see or comment on the long-term impact of those reforms because the first time those reforms were used was at last year's double dissolution election. So we need to see how this plays out at a general election, which hopefully will be the one that's due in 2019. So if I could just start to wrap up my arguments and then open it up for discussion. To try and explain how there has been a shift in the type of minor party elected to the Senate, I'm splitting this into eras. The idea that we had from 1955, the rise of the DLP, up until 1983, where the Democrats were, of course, a significant feature of the Senate, we had a fragmentary party system where these minor parties were either spoilers, they tried to stop a major party from winning government, or they were watchdogs. They sought to use their position in the Senate to be that watchdog, to ensure that neither major party was able to use its power in an unfettered way. But from 84 onwards, we see the rise of what are called, I'm calling, issue competitive parties. And these are parties that are mobilised not so much because of major party fragmentation. They haven't split, in many cases, from a major party. But rather, they are advancing specific policy agendas that are clearly linked to broad new social movements. And new social movements, of course, have become a significant feature of all liberal democracies, especially since the 1970s. The peace and disarm movement, the gender and equality movement, issues that are still being debated today. But they just don't emerge in a vacuum. These minor parties emerge because they perceive there to be some sort of problem in the established major party system. And for many of these parties, it's all about this sense of convergence. Convergence in broad social and economic policy between the coalition and Labor. And a sense that that convergence has strengthened since the 1980s onwards. And so this, to new minor parties, opens up opportunities. It opens up the scope for them to advance specific agendas that neither major party is really concerned about, which often falls to the fringes of the political debate. This doesn't in any way delegitimise what they're out to do, but it actually gives them some oxygen. It actually gives them a role to play in the political spectrum, a niche to fill, and they are doing that very effectively. So I believe it's this change of the source of mobilisation and the role in politics. And rather than seek to be a watchdog, rather than seek to be a spoiler, these new minor parties are all about advancing their very specific agenda in the Senate. Much to the disappointment, much to the chagrin of some major party leaders, especially prime ministers. But that is the reality of new minor parties, that they are doing that and they are doing that effectively. Of course, the exception, I would suggest, is Nick Xenophon, who is that more centrist character and party. But even there, there are clear elements where there's a policy agenda, especially when it comes to gambling, that the party wants to resolve. I would also argue that the changes, the electoral changes introduced by the Hawke government in 83, in time for the 84 election, have made it easier for minor parties to emerge. And, of course, to win seats thanks to preference wheeling and dealing, to swap preferences, to ensure that they all are able to maximise their electoral base, even if they don't get a primary vote. A strong primary vote is a very strong way in which minor parties can win seats in the Senate. And they've been able to do that. As I said earlier, though, the impact of the 2016 reforms is just a bit unclear at this stage. And thirdly, the final point, which pays tribute to the role and significance of the Australian Democrats. The Democrats completely reimagined the role for a generation of what the Senate could do. And they served as a template that once in the Senate, a minor party would be able to exert influence of the policies of national government. And so this idea is a very strong motivating force for new parties to emerge. The chance that if they are able to win a seat, if they are able to win a couple of seats, if they are able to hold the balance of power, then they will be able to address the issues that are of concern to them and their supporters. And that could have only been demonstrated by the pioneers in this, and that is, I believe, the Australian Democrats. So to conclude and have time for discussion, I'd just like to finish up by reiterating the main points. I really am advancing this argument that there has been a shift in the type of minor party elected to the Senate. And these are linked, these results are linked to not only electoral reforms, but also in what's going out in the broader electorate, the sorts of debates that people are engaging with, the sorts of issues that national governments from time to time appear unable to deal with. But even when minor parties do get into the Senate, even if they achieve that incredible dream that so many of them have, it comes with a very, very big question mark, and that is, are they able to, number one, maintain a cohesive organisation, and number two, are they able to withstand the sorts of tactics and challenges that come up from either the major parties or other new entrants into the parliamentary sphere? So I think on that note, I'll pause and we can have time for questions. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, we do have a little time for questions. We've got microphones either side of the stairs there. If you would like to make your way to the microphones, you can. Otherwise, if you put your hand up, we'll arrange to have someone bring a microphone to you. But I think we've got a first taker already. So, over here.
Testing. I was wondering if you thought over the last 30, 40, 50 years there's been an increasing concentration of wealth in a smaller percentage of the population. That seemed to be play a part in Donald Trump's victory. I was wondering if you think it's having any impact on the Australian political system and the minor party representation. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the question. Look, there is clearly a link there. I think there is that sense that there are winners and there are losers. And the candidates and parties that we've seen in Australia, Lambie, Hanson in particular, play on that idea. And there is, of course, we see when real wages are not going up, this sense that there is great uncertainty about traditional jobs that people used to have, especially in the manufacturing sector, where we see metropolitan Australia doing so very well, but the rural and regional areas doing not so well. There is an appetite for voters to see alternatives, to look at what's going on elsewhere. And I think that's where a lot of these minor parties, especially from the right, are able to draw their support from. I think it's, you know, the idea of economics, wasn't it Bill Clinton who said it's the economy? Stupid. I was being very polite, not putting the end part on it. But yes, it's about the economy. It's about responding to the economic and social problems that are emerging. And the economy is very much a concern. And I don't think there's a day that goes by without some sort of press report about the cost of housing, the pressures that people are facing to pay off their mortgages. So it contributes very nicely to the narrative that these parties are putting forward, that the system that we have for the last few generations is broken and it needs to be fixed. And it can't be fixed by a politician, by an established politician. It has to be fixed from someone from the outside. And I think that's the Trump approach and that's the Hanson approach to an extent.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Up here on the left.
Hi. I was wondering whether you're paying attention to the very recent Dutch election, where, of course, had the two major parties in a grand coalition together, and we've just seen an absolute splintering of the vote there, and the combined major party vote going down to about 27%, and, you know, to the point where you could almost say there isn't such a thing as a major party anymore. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about what the relevance of that was to the Australian sphere.
Thanks for the question. That's a great observation to make. And of course, when we think about the European systems in particular, they love to use the proportional representation system that we use in the Senate. But they use it, of course, for electing governments. And whenever you have that sort of system, you're always going to be splintering the vote and ultimately ensuring that any government that gets in will have to deal with colleagues, with coalition partners. The system we use in the Australian voting system in the lower house, of course, cuts all that off. It ensures that it becomes a battle between the two major parties, which amplifies the majority, and you've got one clear winner at the end of the election, usually, barring the last few years. But I do think that there is that very close association with what the electoral system is and what the electoral outcome is. But on that point of the Dutch elections, there is this sense that the right, the political right, the populist right, however they're framed in the media, are on the march. I'm not so sure that they are. I think the another recent European election in Austria, the Greens, the left of centre candidate, did so very well and ultimately defeated the right. We saw in WA this sense that, oh, Hanson, it's going to be domination. I remember speaking to a journalist on the Friday where it was his view that the battle that's already been won, the government's won, the new government will have won, but the main question is how many seats will Hanson win in the lower house? Of course we know that she didn't. The party struggled to win around about 5% of the vote. So while there is much media excitement about these right parties, the electoral reality suggests that they're not the force that they really are. Donald Trump's used as another example, but of course we think about who Donald Trump is. He wasn't just an independent. He wasn't just a right populist candidate. He was the official nomination of the Republican Party. So if Party A isn't going to win, it's going to be Party B. And in this case, Donald Trump, as leader of Party B, was able to use that to leverage the party recognition and lead himself to the White House. Thank you.
And time for just one more question up here on the left.
Thank you for your talk. You have emphasised a number of times that the greatest growth in minor parties is from the right. And in terms of the number of parties, you're undoubtedly correct. But the largest single minor party is surely the Greens, who are a party on the left, probably to the left of the Labor Party. My question is, are there different factors influencing the growth of minor parties on the left from those that influence the growth of minor parties on the right?
Thank you very much for the question. That's a very good question, and it highlights something I probably should have talked about in my discussion a bit more as well. It seems that the left of centre vote for the minor parties is consolidated with the Greens. The Greens, there have been a myriad of Greens, and they only started to consolidate in the late 1990s. And once that started to occur, we see the rise of the Greens as the real third force in the Australian Senate. And once that occurs, of course, there is no more need for another Green Party or another party that advances a socially progressive agenda or another party that is concerned about Australian foreign policy or is another left-of-centre minor party that's concerned about equity and justice and equality. That's all being funnelled to the Greens. Whereas with the right, they all have their own different agenda. Some are about race, some are about immigration, some are about the leadership styles of government, some are about things concerning economic protectionism, whereas some are all about advancing economic liberalism. So there's much more variety that's occurring in the right. And I don't think we see that sense of consolidation towards one party from the right that is able to take in all those different things into account. Whereas with the left, I think the Greens have been able to do that very effectively.
Well, I think that probably brings us to the end. I do make the observation that just in the last sitting period, the crossbench or parties represented on the crossbench increased by one as well with the Australian Conservatives. So the next sitting period starts next week. Interesting to see what that might have to offer. Could you join with me, please, in thanking Dr. Kazarian for his lecture? Thank you.